Thank you for joining us for another Hagley History Hangout. My name is Gregory Hargreaves, Assistant Director of the Center for the History of Business, Technology, and Society at the Hagley Museum and Library in Wilmington, Delaware. Now, you know, during these history hangouts, we like to bring you some of the great work being done by folks using the historical collections held at the Hagley Library, especially scholars who have received funding and support from the Hagley Center in the form of research grants and fellowships of different kinds. One such scholar joins me today. Dr. Amy Edwards is senior lecturer at the University of Bristol. Amy, thanks for chatting with me today.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to it.
Oh, you're welcome. Let's start by painting with broad strokes, so to speak. What is it you're researching and writing about at the moment?
So at the moment, I've just started a new project, which broadly speaking is going to be a history of self-employment or different forms of self-employment. For me, my focus is modern British history, so it's in late 20th century Britain, so from about 1950 to 2000.
And when you mean self-employment, is that different? How do you categorize that as a subject for your study?
Yeah, good question. In some ways, this is what the project is about, is thinking about what self-employment means and what different forms, because it's such a broad brush term. In particular, at the moment anyway, the stuff that I'm most interested in is something I'm starting to call like semi-structured self-employment or mediated self-employment. So ways that people work for themselves or are categorized as independent contractors, but are often working with or not quite for, but much larger corporations and companies. So things like direct sales or franchising, where someone technically owns their own franchise store, but it is also a McDonald's or something else like that.
Sure. Now, from 1950 to 2000, that seems like there must be a pretty broad arc or a number of phases to your narrative. Could you sort of sketch that out for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So in some ways, the story in Britain probably looks a little different than the story in the US, not least because, as in so many things, Britain kind of follows where the US led in this period. So the reason why I've got that chronology for my project is that it's in the 1950s that you start to see some of these big multinational corporations, or at the time, I guess, US corporations, introducing in one way or another these kind of structures or forms of business into the UK. Sometimes they're doing that themselves, or other times it's like a US entrepreneur who sees a setup that is working in the US, moves to the UK for one reason or another, and brings it with him. So some of the early examples of franchising are Wimpy Burger. I don't know if you've heard of them, but
Sure. That's an old
yeah,
one.
they become one of Britain's biggest first franchises, way before McDonald's. But then also companies like Avon Cosmetics, like Amway comes to Britain a bit later. But yeah, it's some of the, Britain also then starts to create its own franchises and its own direct sales companies, but the inspiration very much comes from the US. So that's why it starts in the 50s. And that's the kind of first phase, is the late 50s and early 60s. You start to see a number of these companies and ways of doing business and ways of organizing labor and things coming over. Then in Britain in particular, as you move through the later 70s and into the 80s and 90s, when there's a lot of economic disruption, there's lots of like unemployment, people losing their jobs. You see a pattern, people using redundancy checks or just looking for a different option when employment options aren't so readily available, and you see quite a boom in franchise opportunities and people moving into being direct sales reps and stuff. So I'm quite interested, particularly in that period in the 70s, 80s and 90s. There are economic reasons why it takes off, but I'm quite interested in some of the other reasons why this takes off. Why do so many people find this an appealing option? Why is it at that moment that particular way of doing business, and more broadly, the idea of working for yourself, becomes such a seemingly appealing thing for so many people?
Is it just coincidence? Surely it can't be that supply side economics and the political philosophies that really buoyed it during that period coincide so closely with this turn that you're describing. Am I onto something there?
You absolutely are onto something. I guess the bigger thing that I'm interested in, and this goes for this project and some of my earlier projects, are the ways that socially and culturally people come in to I suppose be sympathetic to ideas that we normally think of as like top-down, politically imposed economic ideas. But for, you know, an everyday person who's maybe not thinking about Hayekian notions of free enterprise and the market, what is it about the concept of owning your own business and working for yourself that is so appealing? And how do maybe some of those more everyday forms of interest in owning a business, owning a home, investing, how do they kind of almost create a fertile ground for then when politicians come to make those arguments about the free market a little later in the like 80s? There's a kind of synergy there, I guess. And I'm interested then in some of the cultural and social drivers of what we might call the rise of neoliberalism, that kind of work alongside, although sometimes seemingly separately to, you know, your Margaret Thatchers and your Ronald Reagans.
Now, I suppose I heard you mention Avon and Amway. I suppose your interest in those firms brought you to Hagley. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. So Hagley House, very wonderfully, the Avon Company Archives. And there's a really fantastic book actually on Avon by, I think, someone else who worked at Hagley, Katina Manko, which is largely about Avon as a company. It's a really great book. I would recommend reading it if you're interested in that kind of thing. But they look at Avon, not exclusively, but largely in America. And so I was interested in if the collections had stuff more specifically about Avon's activities in Britain, and how Avon came to function in Britain. And if it looks different, you know, if the sales reps packages and the advertising, how similar it looks, and or whether there's something also like kind of culturally specific about how this looks in a British context.
And what did you find? I'm fascinated to hear.
Yeah, a really good question. I mean, funnily enough, I have a folder open on my computer at the moment as I'm just working through the stuff. I'm writing some chapters on this as we speak. But the main thing that I was looking at are the packs of materials that were sent out to Avon reps with advice about how to sell, about the role that Avon might play in their lives, about the kind of relationships that they might use as part of being an Avon lady, and vice versa, how Avon lady might shape their relationships with people. So some of what I'm interested in is the very kind of social relations of business, and how lots of things, if we think of business as a world of like rational action and people making hard economic decisions, that actually for a lot of people, business decisions are more about friends and family, about wanting something fun to do on the weekends. I mean, there's a lot of this stuff wrapped up. So I was really interested in the way that particularly women in direct sales pioneered kinds of working that now seem very familiar to us in the 21st century. So working from home, working out like flexibly, managing work-life balance in different ways, and how actually this is going on in the 50s and 60s with thousands of women. But we tend to think of it as like a late 20th century thing, the idea of like home working and flexible hours and the gig economy, and kind of if there are pathways, historical pathways from one to the other, is what I'm interested in finding out.
What came to mind when you were describing that is that the phrase that politics is personal. Well, I suppose you're arguing that business is always personal as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is, so I should say some of my interest in this comes from the fact that both of my parents were self-employed when I was growing up. So my dad ran a small corner shop and my mum ran kind of childminding nursery for kindergarten, I guess, in America. But yeah, nursery kids. And yeah, I was just kind of interested in how they understood themselves. And in fact, my dad was not quite a franchisee, but sort of a franchisee. And I was always so fascinated by the fact that he considers himself very much a local guy who's like a sort of a local businessman, and that he kind of worked from scratch to build up his business, which he did in many ways. But then also he worked for a spa, or ran spa shops. I don't know if they have spa in the US, but it's kind of across European. It's like a convenience store, a bit like a 7-Eleven, I guess.
I see.
Yeah, and I just think that so much of, I guess, my parents' life and my life growing up was also about my dad's free time and like what my mum wanted to do. And she started running the nursery actually after she had left work to have me and my brother. She used to be a teacher before and then didn't want to come back to that. Started working in a nursery school to work kind of part-time and volunteer while me and my brother were there, and then ended up sort of in different ways running a nursery. And so yeah, exactly as you say, that business is as much about people's relationships with each other as it is about kind of hard economics or policy.
Now, what is it about these the sort of business model of the franchise firm or the direct sales firm? On the one hand, it seems like they're say taking advantage of people's social connections that exist outside of profit-seeking relationships and trying to convert them into sources of income. But at the on the other hand, you're also saying that from the point of view of, say, the franchisee or the direct sales representative, that these business models offer some kind of unique opportunity that they can't find in other forms of employment. What's part of the calculus going on there?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question, and a lot of scholars have kind of tried to analyze that, you know, like how much of this is exploitation, what does it mean to monetize people's relationships, to monetize their desire for for women in particular, their desire for flexible working around childcare and things like that. And I suppose more generally, I'm trying to avoid in the project coming to any final judgments myself on how empowering or not these opportunities were for men and women, or how how exploitative or not they were. But I am interested in exactly that, how we can start to bring together histories of big economic change that account for individual people's drivers and motivations, that they're not just victims of kind of the interests of big multinational corporations or governments, or and not always victims, but you know, that they're just subject to the whims of them. But there is something about these companies where they creatively met what felt like a series of needs that people had for different ways of working. And some of those ways that the ways that those two things came together then produced new kinds of norms around working and employment, and thinking about oneself and the like boundaries between personal life and professional life, between home and work, that then by the end of the 20th century mean that we have something that looks really quite different. So I guess that's kind of what I'm trying to do, is unpack that middle bit where those two things collide.
I think it's a really fascinating project. Now, could you give us a little bit more idea what you found in the Avon collection at Hagley? Maybe was there a certain document or set of sources that really made the light bulb go off and made some connections for you?
Yeah, there's some really in the some of the stuff that I found most interesting recently. So as I say, I was looking at these rep packs. The Avon used to have campaigns sort of more often than once a month, actually, but a new campaign, and at the start of every campaign they would send out like order booklets, but also like a magazine for reps called Outlook, and in the magazine there would be items about the latest products, but also sales tips, news about competitions, ways that Avon ladies could make extra money or earn points and earn prizes. And I'm really interested, particularly in the way that they, there's a whole series of packs which were for UK reps that were in the collections that run from about 1959, I think it is, through to the 70s. They're not kind of perfectly, they don't have all of them, but there's a really good body of stuff there. And there's just some really interesting things where, that they advise people about like the home space and about how to use the home and about how to use family relationships as part of their sales tactics. So things like make sure that you call around at times when the husband might be home and try and conduct your sales meeting in a space where it doesn't interrupt him, but he might be able to hear, so that while you're talking, he might then overhear and go, "Oh, you know, honey, I love that perfume. Why don't we order one of those?" Or about kind of, there's some stuff where Avon produced coloring books for children that they encourage the sales rep to take in both as a gift, But the colouring books, the things the children are colouring in, are then items from the catalogue, and the children are meant to look in the catalogue to find the right colours. So it's using all these different like bits of the family and family relations and saying, make sure you take an extra catalogue that your customer could maybe give to the grandparents. Or keep an eye out if the houses around your neighbourhood have prams in the gardens. That means there might be a new baby. And therefore, someone might even more need someone to go around and offer to sell them things for them in their home because the convenience is more important. So all of these ways of using women's knowledge and quite intimate knowledge of their friends and families, lives of what's going on in their lives at that time, and ways of using that then and kind of turning it into soft sale tactics. So I've been finding that stuff really interesting about kind of emotional intimacy and physical intimacy of being in someone's home and what that kind of meant.
Yeah, that's incredibly fascinating, really rich material.
Yeah, I've been having a whale of a time, to be honest.
I'm wondering whether you spotted any differences in the materials designed for the British market as opposed to those designed for the American market.
Thus far, I'm at quite early stages in the project, so it might be a bit too early to say anything conclusive. But what has been interesting is comparing the materials then with the way that some of this was being reported on in the British press at the time, because the British press noticed that there is this kind of suddenly this new influx of new sales techniques that are coming to Britain, and this thing called an Avon lady and this thing called a Tupperware party. And there is a real kind of anxiety about it, about what it means, and that and there's a lot of a kind of anti-Americanism actually in it, like an anti-American strain of being like, I mean, these companies think that they're going to get the British housewife going around people's houses and selling. Are they mad? And then suddenly they realize that these companies really are going to get British housewives who are, you know, meant to be reserved and too, you know, too refined for like brash selling at someone else's house. So there is this kind of, there's at least a cultural anxiety of like American ways of selling coming to Britain, and what that means about like the British character, and if it's being overwritten by American cultural values, which I think makes sense in a wider moment of the end of World War II and like Britain in a moment of real anxiety. It's losing its empire. It's clearly not a kind of global superpower anymore. This is like a wider historical trend, and this is like a weird, I think, expression of it.
Was there a sort of a class element there when you're talking about the British press's skepticism about American companies' ability to get British housewives out on the street as salespeople? I'm thinking immediately about the sort of both middle class versus working class division, as well as the North-South geographical division that especially existed very strongly in the period you're describing. I wonder if how that fit in with this movement toward self-employment.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So the Avon and like direct sales stuff is particularly interesting because it also this is a moment in Britain, particularly as you get into the 60s, of kind of mass affluence. So what I'm interested in is that direct sales comes to Britain in one moment and seems to solve one set of problems, which is allowing middle class housewives largely an ability to earn extra money because we're suddenly entering a period where it's a desire. There's a historian called Helen McCarthy has a great book where she talks about this, but there's a desire for like a life of little extras in a more affluent society, that having, you know, a holiday or having, I don't know, white goods or a nicer car is the thing that is driving women into work. Rather than economic scarcity or uncertainty, meaning that there needs to be an extra income, it's more a desire for like the better things in life. So in the 1960s, it's much more middle class. It's not explicitly stated, but it's reasonably clear that that's a lot of what's going on. But the moment where both franchising and direct sales really booms later on, it's the opposite. They're already kind of well established in British society, but it is this moment of actually, in order to survive, a lot of households need two incomes, and you know, women need to be working around childcare, and in franchising, you know, you might have lost your job, but we need to find a way of of dealing with huge, like very high rates of unemployment here in the early 1980s, like unemployment goes through the roof. So then it becomes a solution for a slightly different set of problems and it changes. So again, I'm interested in why something that comes and takes one form in the mid-century then starts to serve different functions in the later 20th century and what that can tell us.
Well, Amy, thank you so much for sharing your project with us. It's
Yeah,
just really
sure.
fascinating.
And thank you so much for, your interest in the questions and very insightful questions. In fact, it's helped me kind of think about it as I'm going and as I'm about to return to writing about it. So this has been a useful segue.
Oh, you're so welcome. And for the audience, if you would like more Hagley History Hangouts and more information on the Hagley Museum and Library, visit us online. You can go to hagley.org. That's HAGLEY.org. Don't be a stranger.